Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. Now, I'm trying my hardest not to beam with arrogance at the moment, because we had some good news this week. Talk Stew actually has listeners. I didn't think it was going to happen. For some reason, you've been subscribing and downloading. And I don't know why, because we chat shit every week. But you keep coming back. We're charting. We're actually being listened to, which is great. And I'd like to say thank you very much to everyone in the room, except Owen Cutts.
Oh, of course, naturally.
Because in going through some of the reviews, people are saying that... You're the weak link.
Bullshit. Bullshit. People are saying this should be my show.
Unfortunately, that's actually the truth. I think that there needs to be an Owen Cutts fan club.
Okay,
that,
let's get it going, man.
Get worked up.
Let's do it. I'll send badges.
All right, so if anybody wants to make I Love Owen Cutts badges, he will hand them out on your behalf.
Yeah, man.
Done. Okay, joining us for the stew this week, he's been away for a few weeks, or maybe more than a few.
Yeah.
You've been in Australia, right, Uzo?
Yeah.
It's Uzo, the Black Milk Train Man. Welcome back.
Shucks. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you're still super bassy on mic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Got to keep it real. Nothing's changed.
How's Australia?
Incredible.
Yeah.
Picking mangoes, topless.
Thanks for the visual.
Yeah. Did I say topless? Sorry. Did I forget to say topless?
Uzo, your new name might be Mango Picker.
That's an old name.
No. We'll move on. So Uzo's here. Obviously, Owen's here. And our special guest today is none other than a man who beat me to a role that I was desperate to get in my teens. But that's how we met. And I can live with that because we've gone on to become pals. It's Noel Clark. Hello, Noel.
Hello. Yo, what role did I beat you to?
Come on, like you don't remember.
I don't remember.
Oh, how embarrassing. Maybe just see them.
All right, so, I don't remember them people that come second. Like, what are you talking about?
All right, whoa, no, hang on. I didn't come second. I ended up coming about... Wait, no, I ended up coming about 7th or 8th. There is some sense to this. Basically, yeah. I met Noel in the auditioning room for The Bill in about 1997.
But we did it.
Yeah, well, this is it. You got the part I was going for.
I see.
And I think they felt sorry for me. So they gave me like a one-line role.
Who you was made?
I was bullying him.
Oh. No, you're getting... you were looking after me.
Oh, really?
Remember, because the other boys were bullying me and I was Lenny. And remember when the guys came, I was hiding behind the cage and you were like, no, Lenny's all right. You were... See? You've forgotten, bro. I've got it on VHS, bro. I'll find it.
No, man. We go back a long way.
A long time, 97, yeah.
And there's a lot to cover in a conversation. I mean, so much has happened for you since then.
And yourself.
Oh, yeah, one or two bits.
Yeah.
And a lot's happening for you right now. And I don't even...
One or two. You lot should see his mansion, he's refurbished. One or two bits have happened for him.
Well, you say that, but currently Uzo is wearing a scarf and a woolly hat and he's got his hands in his pockets. Owen is zipped all the way up.
Yeah, that's because they got the roof off your palace, but it's coming back. We know that.
Well, fingers crossed. Yeah. There's so much to get into. But before we get into you and career and history and all of that, I think it's kind of important that we tackle where we are in the month. It is February 15th. Mm. I just got off of a flight at 12 o'clock, so a couple of hours ago, I just got off a plane. So I, because of flight, avoided the awkwardness that is Valentine's Day for any single man. Uzo, you were also part of the single fraternity.
Doesn't have to be awkward.
Why doesn't it have to
just
be awkward?
Just go zero tolerance. Zero tolerance.
What do you do on Valentine's Day as a single man?
Whatever I want.
That sounds really dark.
I'm not falling for it. I'm not having it.
Uzo, are the police going to use this at some point for evidence? Because the whatever I want on Valentine's line of conversation.
That was Owen. That was
quite
Owen.
Dark.
Owen said that.
Ted Bundy used to say as well. Ted, what'd you do? Whatever I wanted to.
I just read his book anyway.
Jeez.
On Valentine's Day.
There you go.
Exactly. More evidence.
Oh, there you go.
What did you do as a married man on Valentine's Day?
I swapped Valentine's Day for Pancake Day.
Ah,
okay. So I did Valentine's Day on Pancake Day.
And
I did Pancake Day on Valentine's Day.
Slow down. I'm taking notes.
Why are you looking like bordering on cocky with this switch? Why was that such a good thing?
I don't know, but now I'm saying it out loud. It doesn't feel as genius
no.
as I kind of have felt it.
Did you make heart-shaped pancakes?
No. I went to a creperie and...
Oh, so you didn't even make them?
No. But I am a good pancake maker.
So what was the point of this again?
Yeah, it sounded better in my head. Hold on. It what? Was good.
A crep
I'm just trying to remember the all right, good so, bits.
So, I know the pure road man's starting to take notes. Yo, man's getting sneaks in. A crepery, yeah?
A crepery?
Yeah, I went to a crepery.
All right, so is she not a little annoyed that she doesn't get like roses and stuff on Valentine's Day?
No, she likes what Valentine's Day? So we went to the
yeah,
cinema.
Yeah, no, I get that. But like when all of her friends are going, oh, I'm going here, or oh, I'm buying this little negligee.
No, she cusses them out, man. You got all the people at work. Oh, I got roses delivered.
She's not into it.
She's not into it, man.
Okay. Mm. So it worked. It went well. This day was pancakes.
Well, yeah, it did until I said it out loud. Now, I don't know if it did go well at all.
I think she might be humouring you. No.
Yes. What did you do as a married man on Valentine's
Day? Well, a lot of pressure.
You're going to show me up.
No, man. Well, no. I was working. So I was shooting Bulletproof in Liverpool. And then the missus and kids came up. We had a nice little dinner. And all that kind of stuff.
So after this many years...
Plus it was her birthday last week, so...
Oh, there you go. Double bubble.
Yeah.
After being with someone for so many years, what do you actually write in the card? Do you just like, oh, love you, babe?
I've been with you for a lot of years. You have to remind them a minute, because when you're together, so you can forget. Right. Been with you for a lot of years, and then you say stuff like, but every year gets better.
Ah, bars. Oh,
yeah, nice. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Told on that. Even if you don't really think that...
This is public.
This is going to go out, man.
She don't listen to my work. It's all right. That's what marriage does. You know what I mean? She doesn't listen to this. Even if you don't really mean it, you say it. You know, they like that. Nice card and all that kind of stuff. So it was very nice.
Yeah, how long you guys been together?
15, 16. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Why did you say that like a prison stretch?
Because I was trying to remember. Because you know you get it wrong. But she ain't going to listen to it. Like, right.
Outside of yesterday being the day of love, you just told me something really weird happened to you in Australia. You just got back and we went to go and get a tea before the show and Uzo showed me a video that has scarred me for life. So, all right, as someone who's grown up in a city, you hear lots of things about rural life and life by the sea. I don't really experience that or live in that way. And occasionally I've spent some time in rural areas or by the sea or by a beach or whatever for long periods of time because of filming, because of what I do. And you hear things and you refuse to believe them as real. One of those things is what happens when you get stung by a jellyfish. Uzo, can you elaborate?
So I'm in Byron Bay. I go surfing with my boy Raz. Incredible human being, right? At the day of our lives, the water's amazing. And then suddenly I get stung by a jellyfish, right? Everything changes, right? You think you're a bad man. You think, and then suddenly you're just frozen in the water and you try not to yell. And people are looking at you like, get out of the water. Mm. You're embarrassing us. So I get out of the water and Raz's like, you're all right. I'm like, yeah. Pee on it. First thing I thought, I was just like, straight away, because I've heard this works. He's like, dude, I'm not peeing on it. It's in a car park. And I'm like, literally... If we go anywhere that's more intimate, it's going to be even weirder. Right. So just pee on it. So he pulls down his wetsuit and he pees on my arm.
But hang on a second.
On my arm. Yeah, it was on my arm. Yeah, it was on my face.
Right, so he was wearing a wetsuit, which means that he had to sort of half strip.
Yes.
Disrobe.
He had to disrobe to actually get to the goods.
And it's one of the O'Neills.
The goods.
Goes, yeah, it's like, it's one of those, you know, there's a zip front one, so you have to actually pull it off. So it happened quite slowly. And yeah, it was.
How much pain were you? How much?
It was genuinely a 9 out of 10.
Really?
It was a 9 out of 10. Ooh, and wow. I've been glassed. I've been stabbed. Like, it's a 9 out of 10.
Really?
Yeah. It's a 9 out of 10.
Jesus, you've been glassed. What the hell?
Who
are you?
Sorry. Different podcast.
Different jellyfish.
I took it on Orange Show.
Yeah, come on, my show. We talk about all that crazy shit.
Hey, you listening to Orange Podcast, all the violent chat you want.
So go on, you got stabbed, talk about it.
You're listening to Violence with Owen.
You open you up, fucking hell.
Founder of Shagadad. Oh, can I just say? Right, so we were messing about on the show. A couple of weeks ago, and with Alfie, right? Alfie was our guest, Pointless Blog, and this idea of creating an app called Shagadad for dads that want to have a bit on the side came up. I've been Instagrammed Shagadad as a URL at various stages by different people. So I've been DM'd Shagadad as a purchase.
What, they've bought it?
I think one of them's actually bought it. There was two people that sent me.
It's happening.
Sent me the GoDaddy. Saying, I'm thinking about buying this and this is how much it costs. Do you want in? And then that's I've got amazing. Someone else, I'm pretty sure that someone else has bought it now. I think Shagadad is gone.
I mean,
Anyway, that was a massive sidebar. So you were telling us about your friend
being
romantically undressing.
Yes.
And taking his stuff off in a slow fashion before urinating on you.
Yeah, the point of the story is it works, people.
It works.
I had the welts beforehand. They all went down. The pain subsided. And yeah, I'm just living life now with those wonderful warm memories.
Did it splash on your face or anything like that?
A little bit, innit? Did it?
Like, just
must
like,
have.
He's like, hold your hand down. Put your arm down, is.
You're lucky your friend actually had some pee there. Yeah. Usually you would go pee before you surf, or you'd pee in the sea.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a lot of people do. So he's a good friend.
Yeah, he's a good friend. Like, no, I mean, he got it from
me. He didn't get stage fright. It just straight out.
Well, you know, when duty calls, do you know what I mean? Like, those are the sort of friends you want to do the
What's
amazing
his name? Raz.
Raz, big shout.
Legend.
Yeah, absolute legend.
See, I would worry that in that situation, I'd be so worried about you,
yep.
I would get stage fright. And it just wouldn't happen. And I'd be stood there, you'd be in pain, I'd have me bit in my hand, and it would just be really weird because I'd just be like, come on, Reg, come on, Reg, come on, Reg. And you'll be like, Reg, just relax.
Just rubbing your back.
Talking
me through it. Waterfall sounds.
See, I overcompensate. So I'd be so worried about you. I'd just pee on all of you to make sure that, just in case, like any welts got somewhere you ain't felt them yet because your arms in so much pain you ain't felt the leg or the neck or anything. So I'd just be like, yo,
everywhere.
We just make sure you're all right, bro.
You sure did get your face? Sure.
I think I see a bit on your lip. You know, on your lip.
On your lip.
Random passers by.
Yeah. I'd be like, yo.
Have you been stung? Have you been stung?
Come help us.
I think she's been stung.
I'm running out. Come help. So hold on. This conversation started with you saying you saw a video.
Did it?
Oh, yeah.
Did you film this?
Well, here's the thing.
Oh, man.
Uzo, pray tell, what is the thing?
The thing is, you tell someone the story, it's so much better with a video.
Right. Okay.
So there's three parts of the video. There's part one, there's part two, which no one's seen, and there's the part that Reg has seen, the end part.
And part two is the actual act.
Is the act, yeah.
So you were filming it happen?
Yes.
You were filming someone urinating on your
arm. Sound effects, yeah. You can hear it.
Can you play it now?
No.
Come on, play just for sound. We don't need to look. I just want to hear it. Play it into the mic. Go on.
Just press play.
Just press play.
I'm starting to question how much pain you were actually in if you were filming this.
Hold on.
It's a nine. It's a nine. I'm in a 9 out of 10 worth of pain.
That's a car park. We're at home.
Come on, just play it. We just want to hear the sound.
Feels better already.
that sounds like more than peeing to me.
just referenced the fact that your family came to visit you while shooting Bulletproof,
mm-hmm.
which is something I'm actually quite excited about because you mentioned it to me donkeys ago. So Bulletproof was an idea that originally was a film. And it's now a TV show.
Well,
correct?
it was a treatment that Ashley and I created. Ashley Walters and I came up with this idea years ago in Starbucks in Oxford Street. Right. He just was like, "Let's do something together." We came up with this whole cop thing. We wrote out 6-7 page treatment of what we wanted to do, and then we wanted to turn it into a film.
Mm.
So we enlisted some people that, with myself, wrote a feature that was called something else. That didn't work, so we cut ties with them.
Mm-hmm.
We took back our original idea, which was our whole treatment, which the basic concept is two black cops.
In London,
one married with kids, one sort of the loose cannon type thing. So we took back our original idea and we went off and we developed it as a TV series and now it's getting made by Sky.
Nice. So how many episodes in are you?
It's 6 episodes. We're shooting 4, 5, and 6 at the moment.
Right, and it's Nick Love that's directing, right?
Nick Love is directing. He came on as well and sort of created the rest of the story with us. So it'll be the three of us credited, but it's Ashley and I's original work.
Mm.
He's directing some of the episodes. He's writing some. I'm writing some.
And Nick's a champion. For those that don't know, Nick actually directed the Sweeney, the remake with Ray Winston.
And Plan B.
And that just made London look
cool,
amazing.
Is he
taking some of those lessons learned from that and putting them into the show? Is London going to look as shiny?
No. He is, but cinematically, yes. So we're definitely, you know, we're shooting on 2-3-5, so it's going to have the black board. It's going to look very cinematic, but what we're not using is the shiny part of London. We wanted to give it more of a Wire type feel and use the places that you know, you don't always see.
Nice.
And that you don't always that you don't always show these days.
But you're shooting up north.
Yeah, setting like near, but you know, Liverpool looks a lot like the southeast of London.
Mm.
You know.
So is there any location stuff here?
Yeah, we've done 2 weeks in London to get, you know, pickups and stuff like that. But it's a really exciting show, you know, and it's a very important show because obviously you've got two, you know, it feels like it shouldn't matter, but it still does, unfortunately. So fortunately, what you do have is you have two black cops, detectives undercover who are going around doing cool stuff and sort of bending the rules. And, you know, essentially you're getting like a British version of Bad Boys, but a TV series. And we just haven't had that.
What do you think the reaction to that's going to actually be?
Well, I hope people like it because that's why we're making it.
Yeah.
So far through social media, just through us posting stuff, people seem very excited about it. I think it's important because, you know, when I was young, if you wanted to play a TV show like The A-Team, you had to be BA. And they're like, you're BA. Like, why? I want to be murder. You're BA. But I don't want to be BA. But you're black, innit? You're BA. I'm like, fine, let's play Knight Rider. All right, you're Kit. You're Kit. But I want to be Michael. You're Kit.
You're the car.
You're the car. He's black. You're black. You're Kit. That's it. That's how it used to roll. You know what I'm saying? But now I feel like, you know, young kids, black or white, but particularly the black kids who never had those heroes or those people they could look up to, you know, unless you wanted to be Kit or Mr. T, you know, BA. Now they'll be able to go, yo. And it's not even about being a police or anything like that. It's about going, yo, I can do that. I can achieve that. And the bigger picture is like, yo, I can be an actor and I can lead a show in this country. You know what I mean?
Which is a great way to sort of get to the beginnings of your story as a storyteller.
Yeah.
We obviously met when you were acting and you were working on other people's show and learning other people's lines and other people's scripts. And you were quietly gophering away on your own screenplay, which was Kiddohood.
Yeah.
And that went on to become a huge deal for a lot of people and launch a lot of careers as well.
Yeah.
So can you talk me through a little bit of the motivations as to why you wrote something as a young actor and how it all happened and what it was like being in the center of that whirlwind? Because it was nuts when it all kicked off.
I think when you're in the middle of a storm, though, you don't know you're in it. Do you know what I mean? Like you kind of, they say that the quietest part of a storm is right in the middle of it. You don't kind of know you're there. You're just in there like, yo, this storm ain't too bad. Mm. Everyone around you is like fucked up and shit like that. You know what I mean? So with Kiddohood, I that's where I grew up. Like people often say, well, what, that's not your life. That's not your life. That's where I grew up. That film is basically me and my two friends hanging out like we used to. Mm. You know, the film has been talked of. You know, people have said it's a gang film. It's this and that. If you actually watch it, it's not. It's three boys hanging out on their day off school. Mm. And, you know, we just used to hang out. And I lived in the area. I grew up in Labrook Grove. That was my life. Those are my friends. I saw those things happen, you know, in Labrook Grove or that sort of area. There's council estate here. And across the road, there's £6 million houses. And that's how it was. And that's where I grew up. And so I was just like, I started acting. And I got one job. And I was like, I've made it. This is going to be me. I know what this is it. And I realized very quickly it just doesn't happen like that.
Mm.
But I was always not necessarily academically smart, but socially kind of like switched on. So once I saw things weren't happening, I was like, I'm going to write them myself.
Right.
So I started teaching myself to write by buying screenplays. Faber and Faber used to publish screenplays, actual scripts. You could buy them. So I used to just buy loads of those with my little money. Because I was working at 15, I started working in a sports center, which is at the base of Grenfell Tower, which we'll sure we'll come on to at some point. And I started working there. So I always had a little bit of money, but instead of, I didn't get into weed and all that, like a lot of my friends, I was just like, I was buying screenplays, you know, which was strange for, and I wasn't a bad man, but you know, I was in the, you know, I wasn't bad, but I knew people, I was in the mix and that. So it was weird, but I just, something was just like, man, I need to do better. I need to do better. I got to do better.
And how old were you when you had that script actually produced?
So, I wrote that script. It didn't get produced and made until 2004. Right. But I wrote it in like 1999, 2000. And I had written it for me to play the lead role, as in Trife.
But then you got too old.
Then I got too, that's exactly what happened. I got too old. By the time it got made, we made it in 2004. So four and a half, five years after I actually wrote it. Then it sat on a shelf for 2 years because nobody wanted to put it out. Nobody wanted to make it, firstly. Right. Nobody wanted to make it, firstly, because they were like, this just doesn't happen. I'd go to meetings and, you know, there's me, just an actor who's not even been in the business that long, going into meetings at all these big corporations. And they're like, this just doesn't happen. We love your voice. We love his voice. He's so authentic. He's so authentic. Did you actually grow up on a council estate? Yeah, I did. No, it's so authentic. But this doesn't happen. my kids don't behave like this. I'm like, that's because you live in a fucking six-bedroom house. Nobody wanted to make it. It got made with private money.
So what was the final budget?
560,000.
Look at that. That's insane.
Something like that.
And at that point, I imagine you were shooting on film.
Shooting on film, yeah. 35 mil.
That's unbelievable. So that probably took up the lion's share of the budget.
Lion's share of the budget. Yeah, we got nothing. So then the film got made, and then we were like, look, we made a film. And then no distributor wanted to put it out.
Oh, shit.
They were like, oh, great, you made a film, fantastic. Off you go back to the council. And it sat on the shelf for 2 years. So from 2004, when we shot it, to 2006, it just sat there on a shelf and nobody wanted to put it out.
No. So what were the cast saying at this point? Because you've cast this group of young actors, some of which have gone on to huge things. Like,
they weren't saying nothing. We were all young. Right. So we just did the work. Like, no one was really saying nothing. Like, where's the film? Like, you know, half the jobs you do, they kind of go off into the ether. Everyone was young. No one really knew what they were doing.
I was about to list a few of the names because it is, when you think about it, it's actually kind of nuts.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
Like Nicholas Holt.
Was he
nominated for an Oscar for Single Man?
Yeah, he was presenting. No, I think he was.
For supporting. I think he might have been. Nicholas Holt, obviously Amin Malamine. Who's gone on to, he's fronting Idris's first film, yeah. Yardie, and he's directing his own first film as well.
Rafe Spall.
I mean, look at that.
Rafe Spall.
Jamie Winston. So many young talents.
Plan B in the second one.
Right.
Jacob Anderson. Yeah. Arnold.
How can we forget Arnold Ocean? But obviously he came in the second film.
Yeah.
So much came from that film. Why do you think it sat on the shelf for so long? And why do you think it resonated when it actually did eventually come out?
I think it sat on the shelf because there wasn't, and there still isn't, enough people in the business that come from the working class or diverse enough backgrounds to believe that those things were actually happening.
Mm.
You know, don't be fooled by everything now. It still hasn't changed. Brotherhood was a nightmare to get made.
Yeah, because you're three films later.
Yeah, now. So the third one that just smashed the box office and made more money than the other two put together was a nightmare to get made still after 10 years.
Not to be vulgar and talk money or anything, but you know, when we're talking about film, it always comes back to how much the film makes. So the first film was made for $500,000.
Yeah.
And made how much?
It made about 460.
Okay. So it did. It wasn't in the black.
No, it wasn't. But that wasn't, you know, it made that on 42 screens.
And then did it find an audience through TV?
Yeah, massive.
Is that where it
went? Word of mouth.
Right.
It was before TV. It was DVD.
Right.
It just became one of those films, much like in America ages ago, it was like Porky's and an American Pie. It was one of those films where when you were in year, I don't know what they call them now, but when you were like 15... When you turned, you're in private secondary school, and then you were like 11, 12, when you turned 13, it was almost like a rite of passage. When you turned 13, certain man in the year above were like, yo, listen, you're a big man now, innit? You got to watch this. Like, it was kind of that.
So true.
You know what I mean? So true. Bro, you seen kiddo, you got to watch this thing. And it was like, for a lot of people, it was the first film they saw. It was like sect and the swearing and the thing, and they were like, boy!
And it was London. And the second film was made for a bigger budget.
The second film was made for 1.2.
And made a much bigger return.
And it made 3.3.
Right, and the third film?
The third film was made for 1.1 and made 3.9.
That's incredible.
And bear in mind, I mean, they are incredible results. Bear in mind, we're making these things on 150 screens, you know? And what that means is essentially, if you get a big film like Avengers or stuff like that, they saturate them. They put them on like 600 screens, right? So, for example, with the third film, a good example is Sausage Party came out, big animated Seth Rogen, all these guys. That beat us in the box office. We were number two in the box office, Brotherhood, by £200,000, right? £200,000. They were on 620 screens and we were on 120 screens. So our screens were like packed. Mm. Their screens were dotted around. You see what I'm saying? So it's the concentration. So making that amount of money on 120 screens is a massive success. If we would be on 620 screens and made that, you'd be like,
yeah. See, the landscape now versus what it was when you started is entirely different.
Yeah, Brotherhood would have made about 7 million if the landscape hadn't changed in terms of Netflix, Amazon, all these different avenues. If Brotherhood sort of had come out like the year after Adulthood, that 3.8 equivalent that we made now would be about 7 million.
That's insane.
So that's a successful film. We beat so many films. Brotherhood was, and I go back to the same people that when I talk about there wasn't enough diversity in terms of decision makers and people and distributors and that, They will never tell you this, but Brotherhood was the second highest grossing British film that year, after third highest grossing after Eddie the Eagle and The Danish Girl. So Eddie the Eagle, big film, was on like 400 or 500 screens. The Danish Girl, Oscar movie, and then Brotherhood. We beat Street Cat Named Bob. We beat Ricky Gervais. We beat all those other British films that came out that year. We beat them. But you'll never know that unless I tell you that, because they don't want you to know.
So what would you put the climate down to now? If you're a young filmmaker that wants to tell a London story, what are your chances of success, and what sort of reception do you think you'll receive? Like, basically, I'm asking you, what would you say to the 21-year-old version of
depends,
you right now?
It depends. See, but that breaks down into different... It's like a Rubik's Cube. That breaks down... It depends where they're from, the director. Depends if they've written it as well. Depends what their cast is. You know, depends if they're anointed or not. Because there are people in the industry that, from the moment they come out of drama, film school, people are like, hand behind the bottom, pushing them like, yo, go here, meet this person, championing them. And sometimes those people... Boom.
Do you know, you're from West London. What do you have any memories of the film coming out and, yeah, and what it depicted?
Yeah, it was exactly that. It was exactly that. People passing around the DVD and we just go and smoke weed and watch it. And just like it really was. Yeah. I didn't see it at cinema, but I did see it on DVD. So like what you're saying is absolutely true. And I'm from West London. And it was this kind of film where it was like they spoke like people from
spoke,
school.
Yeah.
Mm. Spoke how you spoke and did what you did, and also it escalated how things often escalated. I remember I was at a party once, and normal party, you know, having fun, whatever. Then house parties in West London were always a little bit like they were either at a posh house that you kind of gate crashed, and so you were effectively the sort of like wrong'uns, or it was in the bits, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then it could be like, fuck, anyone could turn up to this. But I remember a friend of mine got really badly hurt and got both his legs broken at a party that just suddenly just switched. And it was like, shit.
Was that one of the things that the industry at the time were resisting against, because they didn't think that that was authentic? They didn't think that that escalation that you've just spoken about, Owen,
could actually
happen?
No, I think they just didn't want to accept that young, you know, it's like everyone reach, it's like when you reach 30, you forget what it was like to be a teenager. And I think they didn't want to accept the fact that the music was changing, that young people were having sex and young people were finding ways to find drugs and all this kind of stuff. You know, a lot of people like, sometimes, you know, I get, you know, your film is the very reason that the society's falling. And I'm like, listen, society informs the movie, not the other way around. The movie could not exist without the things happening already. These were things I saw. That movie, particularly the first one, is things that I literally had seen and things that I had lived. You know, that's where it came from.
Lisa, you're someone who does lots of different things. I mean, you're a photographer, also a writer, director yourself. Do you? How much would you say your experience informs the things that you write?
Yeah, I think a lot, but not directly my experience, if you see what I mean. So it'll be a representation of the effect of that experience, if you see what I'm saying, as opposed to, because what you're saying is it was more kind of autobiographical in that sense.
Parts of it, not the uncle with the gun and all that, but generally,
So what my sort of thing is more like experience. The way that I would see something would come out in my work. You know what I mean? So I think it's similar, but very different.
So what's your attitude towards a lot of the things that have been said recently about young talent such as yourself having to go to America to find work and to actually find...
I'm not young, for a start, but...
You could have fooled me.
Well, you know, the black don't crack is what this is. It sheds, though, sheds its old skin. My thing is this, is like, people should go where the work is and go where the opportunity is. And this country still is in a place where, you know, the opportunities are not as as great as they are in America. So people are going to go. I've been lucky in that film in particular, and the fact that maybe Doctor Who came out at the same time and off the back of an Olivier, like those three things sort of, you know, you can't kind of have one out of the other. And it's not me trying to go, this is my CV, but I think the combination of those three things that happened at the same time put me in a position where I was able to do more work, and I've carved out a career where I haven't had to do that. You know, people have had to go there to live because there just wasn't enough here.
Yeah. Just you mentioning the Olivier and Doctor Who and America all in sort of one statement has thrown so many things into my mind that I kind of feel that I have to say. One of which is that, first and foremost, I'll never forget the conversation that we had when I got cast in Doctor Who. And you pulled me to one side and went, "It's about to get real now, Reg." Because you were like, "Reg, it's a different thing.
It's a different thing."
And you're not wrong. No. I mean, I did like 5 episodes.
Yeah, but it's different, man.
And to this day, I still get stopped and people talk to me about Doctor Who. I can only imagine what you've experienced. Yeah, and that's one thing. And the other thing is, I got off a plane, as I said, this morning, coming back from the States, working on a show that I've written and I'm directing.
Yeah.
And the reason I started writing was because of you. I don't even know if you remember the conversation, but you sat
You've told me, I don't know if I remember the conversation, but you have told me this.
It's amazing. So Noel sat me down and he said, "Right, Reg, I spoke to Plan B last week and I'm talking to you today. Listen, it can't just be my voice. You're smart, you need to write." And I was like, I don't know. You need to write. Shut up, you got to write. You need to write, you need to direct. Yeah. You need to go out there, it can't just be me. I spoke to Plan, he's got to write a film. Now his film has come out. I've just made shorts.
But it doesn't matter though. You
but
know what I mean?
Like, I'm working towards it, but I'm eternally thankful for that conversation because it really started something in my mind. I imagine you've had that conversation with a lot of people.
Lots
right?
of people, yeah.
And what has it gone on to?
Well, I mean, different levels of things for different people. Some people are still writing, some people are only wanting to direct. But I try to say to everyone, you know, you have to create your own work, because if you don't, you're not gonna survive in this business. This business will eat you up. Hmm. I want actors to come into this business, not just as actors but as creators. So you because eventually you get, there's only so much acting work. There's only so much, and there's still a glass ceiling. So actually the way you break the ceiling or circumnavigate the ceiling or climb the wall or go under the wall is by creating your own work, creating your own path. And that is why, you know, I've never had to I don't want to say run off to, because people have to go where the work is. But, you know, in terms of some people have had to go to America to live, to be able to pay their mortgage, to do this. I've never had to do that because I'm probably one of the people, even though I've told a million people to do it, I'm probably one of the first people that's just gone, hit my head against the wall and gone, all right, I'm going to get past this wall.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to throw this out to you because I'd really love to get your take on this, guys. We spoke about Amelamine, we sort of just mentioned him anyway, we were talking about Kid Ulthood. For those that don't know or don't really remember, Amel had a successful TV career, he was in the Bill for years, and he also led the first Kid Ulthood movie. Yeah. Played Trife, the little gun driller. Now, Amel and I had dinner a couple of nights ago in the States, and Amel's doing amazing things. He's the lead in Idris's new film, Yardi, and he's directing his own feature film as well. And Amel is one of that group of young actors who are absolutely killing it at the moment.
Yeah.
And he had this incredible theory that I'd never heard before, and I'm annoyed because I wish I'd come up with it. And he compared the deal. I sort of asked him, I said to him, "Look, why do you think it is that so many young black British actors are getting the roles that these young African-American actors aren't getting?" And his theory was, and it's fucking genius, and I'm so annoyed. He said, there's two different types of performers, right? You have got the guys that have charisma, and then you've got the guys that have craft. Now, for American casting directors and for American film, they look at British actors as coming from a world of craft because we have that that legacy of of stage. We have that legacy of serial drama, theatre, etc. Whereas Wesley Snipes, charisma. Will Smith, charisma. All of these actors that we think about, they're characters that are bigger than life. And they're characters that can walk into a room and just light it up just with their charm. But when it comes to actually doing the work, there's one or two that you can name, maybe Denzel, maybe Forrest Whitaker, but the rest of them are charisma guys. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that theory? Do you agree? Do you think that there's anything in it? Because I was like, that's so good.
There's definitely something in it.
Right.
I think that there's another thing that people might not have noticed, that if you come into a casting and you're English, you're like, "All right, mate, my name's Dave. Do you know what I mean? And I want to play the part of,
LaShawn.
And then all of a sudden, like, "Yo, what a player, you know, I'm going to do this." Like, all of a sudden, they're like, "Oh, you're really acting." Mm. And then when you come and you say, "Yo, my name is Ford, I'm going to play the part of LaShawn." And okay, so whatever. And he's just doing the same thing. So I think that you get to really see that this person is actually transforming themselves when they go from English persona in the casting to like this character that they're creating. Yeah. To me, I think that's even another thing that adds another level to
it. What do you reckon, though?
Well, it's like Idris in The Wire, man.
Yeah.
I thought he was American.
Yeah. Yeah, so did I.
Like, proper convinced. And someone said he's from Hackney. I was like, shut up. Ring of Bells English, there we go. But for me, I mean, I can only sort of talk about it from my industry, and it's drive and talent. And if you have just talent, it's not really ever going to be enough.
Is it the same in music? Because there are so many British people doing brilliantly. I mean, like your mate Jimmy, for instance.
Yeah.
Jeez, he's got an Oscar.
He has got an Oscar.
Do you know what I mean? For music. That's
quite heavy,
mate.
You know,
where does he keep his Oscar?
On his piano, next to his four Grammys. And he's out of an
Oh my God. Yeah. That's your pal.
That is my
that's
pal.
Just your mate.
From ages. Yeah.
Why do you think that it's happening in music and in film?
I think there's always been something about England. And for a long time when we were growing up, I personally looked to America. Oh, I love basketball. I love hip hop. Like, oh, America's so amazing. Yeah. Like, wow, the movies and
culture.
All the smoke coming out the streets in New York, you know, all that shit. And then I went there. And for a holiday, and it was great. And then I went there for work, and I was like, America's not all that, man. Like, when you're there, you're like, well, this isn't quite what I wanted it to be, I guess. And then I came home to England, and just for example, LA is very straight, and all the buildings, well, in sort of like West Hollywood anyway, all the buildings are rectangles, boxes, and you know, you come home to Soho and everything's winding and there's old and new and there's so much rich culture. I just think like English people have a kind of like inane ability to draw upon where they're from. And I personally think that some Americans get lost when they're trying to draw for things.
Yeah. What do you reckon, Noel, then, on that charisma versus crafting? Because the list is ridiculous. Who we got? We've got Amel Amin. You've got Damison Idris. You've got Ashley Bashy. You know, yeah, Ashley Thomas doing amazing things.
I've seen them a couple of nights ago. I think two things. I think one is what the young people. Some of them realize. Some of them don't. What they are benefiting from is the world in itself has become more global. And so, you know, I talked to you earlier before we started about when I went to LA. After Kid Rock had popped and they were like, come to LA. I went to LA. There was no one there. And when I mean no one there, I mean none of us were there. There was no... I got cabs. I got cabs everywhere because there was nobody there to say, right, when you go to LA, you need to rent a car.
Rent the cheap Mustang.
You need to do this. You need to do that. You need to blah, blah. So I didn't know. Yeah. What these guys are benefiting from, the guys that are 10, 12 years younger than me, about 8 years younger than you or so like that. What they're benefiting from is that there's a raft of people there now, so whenever they go, they know what they need to do from the outset. Yeah, the other thing, so they're benefiting that, and that the world's more global in terms of, you know, Netflix has been around at least 5-6 years now. The YouTubes is, you know, you can do something in your bedroom in London and they can see it in America. Do you know what I mean? So the world is benefiting in that. The world is a lot smaller. You don't even need to be in a room anymore. It helps, but you can send tapes, you know. The other thing is, the charisma drive thing, I talked about this the other day with Bashy actually, and I do agree with that, but there's something else. If you have all the charisma in the world but no talent, you're not going to get anywhere. If you have all the craft in the world but no charisma, you also will only get so far. Having both of those things and the drive is the most important thing, because I know actors that are 10 times better than me, but they're homeless now or working in supermarkets. And the reason that is not because they ain't got more charisma. Some of them do. It's not because some of them haven't got better craft. Some of them do. Nobody's got more drive than me out of the people I'm talking about. Nobody. So when they got to a spot and they're sitting in their chair like, yo, this chair is good. I'm like, I'm taking your chair. And that's how I've always rolled. And I think that you cannot succeed without drive. You cannot succeed without drive. And some of these people that we talk about, even our friends that success comes to them later, is when they've banked on their charisma or they've banked on their craft only, and they've only got to a certain age and realized actually, you know, they get the humbling and then they go, actually, I need the drive. And they get to an age when they go, boom, and that's where you focus. I've always had it. You've always had it. Some people just have it. So, you know, if you've got the charisma and you've got your craft, and you can even learn your craft. You might not have it naturally. You've got the charisma, you've learned your craft, or you have your craft, but you also have the drive. That is what's happening.
Yeah, two names that I didn't mention in that list was Daniel Kaluuya mm-hmm. and John Boyega.
Yes.
Two amazing British actors who have really, you know,
earned
their stripes on the stage in the West End. They've done the thing. They've done the thing on telly.
Shining.
And now they're leading huge Hollywood movies.
I think John Boyega could be James Bond, will be James Bond.
Before Idris?
Idris won't get it. Here's what will happen. I don't think they're ready for a black Bond. So there'll be another white guy for the next after the, Daniel Craig.
Can you call it? Who do you think it will be?
I don't know. But I think that guy will do 6-7 years. John will be about the right age. And then John Boyega will be the first black Bond.
Do you think there'll be a black? Do you ever think there'll be a black Bond?
What? Yeah, his name's John Boyega.
It's so funny just hearing you speak. I'm being reminded of just some of the things that you've actually achieved, because you have a BAFTA.
I do, yeah.
You have a BAFTA. Mm. And does it ever frustrate you that people don't necessarily look at you in the same light as your peers? Because, you know, you're a BAFTA winning, Olivier winning, Doctor Who acting, writing, directing, show
brand
running,
creating.
Brand creating. You've written and directed a trilogy. There's not many British directors that can say that.
The first British trilogy.
The first ever.
Yeah, closely followed, weirdly, by Bridget Jones only 3 weeks after, but the first British trilogy.
I mean, that's ridiculous. Do you ever get frustrated in terms of the way in which you're seen and perceived versus your actual achievements?
The short answer is yes.
I could have told you that.
Yeah, the short answer is yes, but it's a lot more of a complicated answer. The longer answer comes down to, you know, I hear the stuff. You know, the longer answer is, you know me pretty well. It's mostly is water off a duck's back. I don't give a fuck. I've always been a lone wolf and I do my own thing. You know that. You've known me for ages. But the little percentage that does kind of grate on me is the fact that there's a lot of people doing a thing now. There's a lot of these bougie actors in the theatre. And I'm talking about our people, yeah? So I'm talking about the black people, yeah? That there's a lot of them in the theatre or doing TV or doing films that are doing stuff that they consider worthy and that they deem worthy. And what they don't realise is the door that they walked through to get those jobs, the door that they walked through to get on stage, to get in these films, to get in these things, the door, that, you know why they walked through it? Because I kicked it down. That's why they walked through it. And a lot of them don't appreciate that. And that's the reality of it. Because when I was doing this stuff, how many people you know writing and directing now? Loads of people. But they weren't all doing it before.
Yeah, I will always say till the end of time that you're the reason.
Do you know what I mean?
I did, because you told me to. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe you're right. But there was a lot of confidence, yeah, but, I think, gained from your success.
But people like yourself, and I'm not talking about people paying homage. I'm not saying like every time I walk in the room, you've got to light 10 candles. I'm not talking, you know what I mean? I'm not talking about that. But you've said it publicly. I'm talking about those people that are just out there acting like they sliced bread for the first time. And they're forgetting that they were eating toast when they was a baby because I was making toast. You see what I'm saying? And that's a little thing that it does irk occasionally when you get these bougie theatre actors who show no respect. But I've got your Olivier. I've got your award. The very thing you define your career on, you're aiming for. I've got one on my shelf next to my BAFTA. Do you know what I mean? And I think people forget that because those films were so big. Like, it's easy to kind of go, well, they're little British films. They are in the grand scheme of the world. But they were so big that a lot of people think I'm that. A lot of people think I'm that.
So what do you see this TV show doing for you and also doing for that next generation of actors that are coming through?
It's just opening more doors, man. You know, like, it literally is. It's like there goes another glass ceiling. There's two black leads in a British show. There was a show last year with Adrian Lester and Sophie Okonedo.
Yeah, BBC One.
BBC One. And I'm not making excuses, because you can always make excuses.
Well, I can't think of anything.
That's Adrian Lester and Sophie Okonedo. Yeah. They're both Oscar nominees and this kind of stuff. And they're kind of anointed in that kind of respect. You know.
Prior to that, the only thing I can think of that had black leads on the BBC was Baby Father.
Yeah.
And that's 10 years ago, 15 years
ago? Longer than that. 2020 maybe.
Yeah, it was Will 97.
Johnson, John Gillett.
That's like a long time.
He says Jalay, but I call him Gon Gillett. He doesn't like that.
So yeah, this you feel that...
But that was considered a black show, so they were like, yeah, you know.
So you think that this will do a similar thing in terms of what Kid Ohold achieved?
100%. I'll show you the promo after. I've got the promo on my laptop. I'll show you a lot after. And basically, will it do what that achieved? I don't know. It's very different. Times have changed, but it's something that is opening doors that haven't been opened before. Mm. You know, apart from Idris... who's a shining light, a beacon for a lot of us. apart from him, but you know, he's a bona fide movie star. But apart from him, who's getting to really lead shows that are millions and millions of pounds per episode? You know what I mean? That then can sell internationally. This will open the door for so many people that, you know, but that's what Ashley has done. That's what you've done. That's what I've been doing for years. And as I said, the only thing that sometimes is like, people should respect that.
Do you see the show as going international?
100%. 100%.
And finding a home on an American network or a streaming service, so it's global?
Yeah, 100%.
That's really exciting.
I don't doubt that at all. Mm. There's nothing like this. There's not even anything in America like this right now. Because even Lethal Weapon is Damon Wayans and the other guy, the white guy, I don't know his name. I can't think of any cop shows with... Yeah.
That feels like a long time ago, Baby Father. You sort of nodded on that. Do you remember it? Funny, because that feels like a
just
moment
about,
in time.
Just like, about remember it.
That's like 20 years ago.
Yeah, 20 years. Yeah. Or 18, something like that.
Yeah, 100%.
So where are you at with your writing and directing? Because obviously, as a photographer...
I'm so glad you brought this up. You know why? Because I was sitting here, right? I had that conversation that you had with Reg. I had that conversation with you, bro. Do you remember it?
Which one?
I know you didn't remember. I was talking to you about being a cinematographer because my background's photography. Do you know what you said to me?
Go on.
I said, nah, bruv. You got too much to say. That's what you said to me.
Bruh.
You got to direct. You got too much to say. Yeah. Estelle was in town. We were having dinner at that place. Do you remember this?
No.
You don't remember this? Yeah. So I had the conversation with you.
No way. And you've won awards now for your film and stuff.
So the next one, they've all been short comedies, but this one's just a tragedy. It's just aggressive.
Yeah. Is it short or feature?
Short, yeah.
And do you think that shorts are the way to go about it? Because that's how I've started.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
There's no correct answer though, is there? People get there in their own ways. And I think each and every way is as equally valid as the other. It's about the three things. It's about the craft, the charisma and the drive.
Okay. All right. Well, before we wrap it up, I just want to know from you who you think we should be looking out for and who you think those next sort of talented voices actually are, because you've identified so many over the years that have gone on to do great things. Who's that next set of people that we'll be getting excited about and talking about a lot?
Ashley Thomas, definitely.
Yeah.
I know, like you mentioned him, but you know.
So talented.
You know, and I don't know if he loves or hates me mentioning this, but when I met him and I said to him, listen, just stick with me, man. You'll be all right. You know what I mean? He was still driving a bus. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
He openly talks about being a bus driver.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, we're talking about Bashy the musician. He's quite well known for the song he released, Black Boys.
Yeah.
But subsequently, he's gone on to do very well as an actor. He's in Black Mirror. 24. He's in 24, the American show. He's done brilliantly. And he's doing a ton of stuff now.
I think he will be someone to watch for the long game. Mm. When you look at him, he doesn't immediately scream movie star. But what will happen is, as long as he keeps doing the American TV, what that does, it will put you in the homes of millions of people around the world. Mm. And once you're in enough homes and enough people know you around the world, you have value.
Yeah.
And movies get picked up on value. And they go, well, we can't put these black guys in it. Who's going to watch them? They go, oh, they'll watch him because they know him from this, that, and the other.
The Night Of, let's not forget that. He was amazing in The Night Of.
And so, like, I think... He's more your Gary Oldman type, Denzel type, I think. Like
craft, the long term.
Yeah, definitely.
Listen, Noel, thank you so much for coming through, man.
No, thank you for having me, man.
I feel like there's still so much to get into.
Well, you know, we could talk all day, man.
Yeah, we didn't even really talk about Grenfell. Can we close out on that?
Sure.
It's quite a somber way to close it, but it's an important way. We spoke about this a little while ago with Rich when he came on the show, and it was really interesting to get his take on what happened there. I spent a bit of time there making a documentary on it, which will be on screen soon on BBC Two, so please keep an eye out for
it.
You
didn't chat to me about it, would that?
You don't need to, bruv. We don't need to. We don't need to talk because anyway, tell me now how you feel about what happened and what your connection to the building was. Well, you said you used to train at the sports centre, right?
Well, I used to work. My connection to the building is that I grew up opposite it. Like, you know, and my mom still lives there because she's like, me, I don't want to move. Keep your money for you and your children.
She's still in Latimer.
She's still around there, yeah. And we live opposite. And I grew up there and I worked in a sports centre on the other side. That's basically, I lived in the shadow of that building my whole life. And the take on it is simple, is my dad lives in one of the other towers. That's the only tower they put the cladding on. Mm. It's the only tower. The reason they put the cladding on that tower is because the new build apartments over at the side of Latimer Station, when they look out their window, that's the tower they see. And so, you know, their property value couldn't increase unless things were looking a bit better. you know, because the other four towers, including the one my dad lived in, they didn't put any cladding on those, and they've been trying to pay them out, pay the residents out to get out and all this kind of stuff. So they put the cladding on there, and we know what happened then. It's a building very close to my heart. It's an area close to my heart. I lost people I know in there. People I knew got out. The first fireman that went in, that you see him on the news, Dave Ballhead, he worked in the sports centre with me. We're mates. Our friend that we worked with, his daughter and the other brother stroke niece didn't
Jessica.
Jessica. Yeah, she didn't survive. And so it's I was down there like hours after. It's a very, I think the councils and the government have a lot to answer for. And basically that fire is a direct result of the gentrification of that area. Mm. And what they're trying to do will push everyone out, because if people don't know it, it's prime real estate. You know, it's prime real estate. There's a lot of social housing there, but it's prime real estate. It's 10 minutes walk from Portobello Road. It's 10 minutes walk to Kensington High Street. It's 5 minute drive to Westfield. It's like, you cannot get more prime real estate in the country than that. And so they've been trying to buy out residents from their flats that they gave them right to buy a few years ago. And, you know, for the things they can't knock down, like that tower was one they couldn't knock down because it's attached to three walkways, Hurstway Walk, Barrandon Walk and Clarendon Walk, because it's attached to three walkways where, again, I used to ride my bike up and down all the time when I was a kid. So they tried to make it look pretty, and that's what happened.
For someone that grew up in an area where you have that culture smash, that I think is a massive defining feature of London, where you have that council estate with the £6 million house, as you said, you know, that's my area, that's Holloway, that's where I grew up. When you're in a borough like Islington, you're in the royal borough of Kensington and Chelsea. And you're growing up in a council estate, when you do see that wealth, it can do lots of things to you, positive and negative. With the area being what it is, and with this tragedy happening, do you think that there is a greater divide between the haves and the have-nots now as a result, or do you think it pulled people together as a community?
I think the divide is between the authorities and the people. You know, the haves and the have-nots in that borough in particular have been there. It's been there since I wrote Kiddohood, since Richard Curtis wrote Notting Hill, when we only lived 10 minutes walk from each other. Like,
those, it's the same area.
So those films are the same area.
That's such an interesting point.
Those films are about exactly the same area. Yeah. And I could walk to that blue door from my council flat in 10 minutes flat. Like, it's the same area. You know, so the haves and have-nots have been there the whole time, and we've got on for the most part the whole time. The divide is with, and people are, they've got what they've got. You know what I mean? I went to school, I never left. I went to primary, secondary, college, all around there. The divide is with the council, and divide is with the authorities that have, and the divide is with probably the new people that are coming in, and the buyers that don't live in the country that want a second flat or a home in London that actually don't care about the communities. I mean, that's where the divide is, and I think, you see me, they don't really want to get on the wrong side of me. As long as whenever they rebuild what they build, there's enough social housing to make sure that area stays the way it is, then there won't be problems. But if they do, what I know they will try and do is go, no, we are going to make social housing, but keep it as like the 17%, which legally they have to do, and make some £3-4 million apartments, then there's going to be problems. And I think that's, they need to be aware of, you know, what they're dealing with, and the fact that there are people that just can't afford the houses that they want to put there.
See, that's one of the dopest things that I think you've said, and that hopefully people will take from today's conversation, and that is that Notting Hill and Kiddohood are films about the same area.
Same area.
Just very different experiences.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because those films weren't released that far apart.
No.
So no matter what you think about the people living in the area of Grenfell, if you want to know more about how different those experiences are, maybe watch those two films.
Yeah.
Right?
Back to back.
That's a double bill, right?
Yeah.
That's one hell of a double bill. On that, I think we should close it out. Noel, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks
through,
for having
man.
Me.
I really appreciate you.
Nice
really
to
good
meet
talking
you guys.
To you, man. That nice has been you. Another Talk Stew. I guess we'll see you next time. Talk Stew is a Pixie U57 production. Now don't forget, you can hear more bonus content from The Stew on Deezer.com.
Deezer. Originals.